This podcast is sponsored by AAA, the American Automobile Association. AAA members get discounts on tickets, resort accommodations, and more at Walt Disney World and other Orlando attractions. If you book a qualifying Walt Disney World Resort vacation package at select AAA offices, you'll receive a free subscription to touringplans.com, as well as dedicated trip planning resources just for AAA clients. Go to AAA.com or ask your local AAA travel agent for more details on this offer. Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's Len Testa here with Jim Hill. Today we're going to be covering Fantasyland in Disneyland. Fantasyland, obviously one of the most important lands in any Disney theme park, and obviously one of the things that Walt himself spent a lot of time on. But first, before we get started, let me welcome Jim back to the show. Jim, how's it going?
I'm sorry.
Fantasyland. All right, so Jim, Walt has this idea for a theme park. At what point does Fantasyland come into the mix? So at what point does Walt say, okay, we're going to take the cartoon characters or characters that we've developed and we're going to put them in a land and we're going to call it Fantasyland?
This dates back, I mean, if you can believe it, this is 1938, 1939.
Really?
You know, I mean, this was when...
17 years before the park was opened.
Absolutely. I mean, this was when Walt was actually thinking about doing a two-acre version as sort of an extra added tour for the park, or for the studio. You know, people were clamoring to get into Disney Studios, and what are you going to do? You know, it's just like there's nothing to see. That it's a bunch of fairly bland-looking buildings in Burbank. And more to the point, this was also during a period where, frankly, Walt needed the money, that the European markets had dried up because of World War II, or the coming of World War II. And they just wanted to do what they could. And so, you know, there's a model maker, Bob Jones, who actually did some very serious work on a Geppetto shop walkthrough, a Seven Dwarfs mine train ride through. And, you know, so Walt always had this tucked away. And, you know, mind you, if you look at the early iterations of the plan for Disneyland back when it was going to be built, you know, there was the Mickey Mouse Park, and it was going to be built across the street from the studio, that was more of a celebration of America. It was the western section and Main Street and not so much characters. But once they came out to Anaheim, once they started looking here, you know, Fantasyland came back in a big way. But at the same time, they never, you know, there were so many things they threw against the wall to try to see if they'd work. I mean, for example, there was the Monstro Shoot the Chutes attraction. I mean,
Monstro Shoot the Chutes. So Monstro the whale from Pinocchio.
Literally, you would come up to this giant. I mean, literally, picture Monstro the whale the size of Big Thunder Mountain. All right. I mean, so he's literally a monster, but his jaw is distended down into a bay of water, and the idea is that you got in a boat. You know, that went into, basically, again, you know, that you entered Monstro's elementary canal, which moved you up a set of show scenes, which, you know, walked you through the story of Pinocchio until finally you're inside Monstro and Geppetto and Pinocchio have started the fire and you're going to escape, and you literally slide down the tongue into the bay and escape from
Monstro. I don't know why that I did. It didn't get put into production.
Bruce Bushman, who did a lot of the design work for the early Fantasyland attractions, I mean, he came up with a wonderful rendering of this. There was an old mill Ferris wheel, but again,
it's not a bad idea.
Yeah, they were Donald.
But Walt hated Ferris wheels. I thought.
There we go. You know, there were Donald Duck bumper boats. I mean, there were all of these ideas that sort of got thrown, you know, that's thrown up against the wall to see what worked. And in the end, the problem was that, you know, Walt, I mean, he kept finding money, but there was only so far the money could go.
Right.
So he knew that, all right, people liked Snow White, so he was going to do a Snow White ride.
Okay. Was that part of opening day?
Yeah, that was an opening day. There was also Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, which was actually, in its earliest iteration, was a indoor roller coaster. There was Peter Pan.
All right, so was the Peter Pan ride in its existing form, or was there a prior version of it?
No, that I mean, don't get me wrong. Everything you see here is second generation because, again, there was only so much Walt could do with the money that he had.
Okay.
And so, for example, he had always envisioned doing the Bavarian village that Bob had designed for, you know, the version at the studio.
Okay.
But, you know, he just couldn't stretch the money far enough to do that. So what he ended up doing is they ended up going with a sort of a tournament tent design.
So, tournament tent is sort of the dominant feature of Walt Disney World up until the redo.
Mm-hmm.
Huh, interesting.
So they end up doing that instead. And they end up doing dimensional flats in a lot of places where they wanted to do full sculpts. And don't get me wrong. I mean, the money was spent. Aero Design, the company that from Mountain View, California, that Disney hired to create a lot of these rides. I mean, for example, we're sitting right now next to Dumbo the Flying Elephant. And, you know, when Aero came up with this wonderful design for Dumbo the Flying Elephant, where literally once it started up, the ears flapped.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful thing that worked for a week and a half. And, you know, then after that, that they, you know, as soon as they could, they...
One ear would flap.
And likewise, there were things that Disney found out the hard way that kind of bit them in the butt. I mean, for example, the idea on the Snow White ride is that you were Snow White. That, you know, that you were in the car. Once you were in the car going through the attraction, okay, you experienced everything that Snow White experienced.
Right, but to this point, right, so that's a radical departure from Disney theme park rides, because pretty much every other ride you're sort of riding through the scene as an observer.
But that's the thing that you understand, learning curve, that you have this situation where this is our first time doing this sort of thing. And don't get me wrong, that there were versions that worked wonderfully right out of the gate that people loved immediately. I mean, face it, you know, Peter Pan, you know, looking down at the cityscape.
Yeah,
that's worked from 55 going forward. People have loved that. Likewise, again, even without the flapping ears, you know, you look at the line here today of the kids who are lining up to get on
Dumbo.
I mean, you know, just there are just some of these things were hits right out of the box. On the other hand, where Pinocchio is located, because they just ran out of money, they decided rather than making a ride, they'd do a movie theater. In fact, they showed 3D movies in there for years.
Really?
Yeah. But it was just stretching the dollar as far as it would go. And even then, Walt got this open in 55 and wasn't able, for example, to get the Alice in Wonderland ride open till 57 or thereabouts. You know, just...
That's not an original attraction?
It depends on how you consider original attraction. I mean, don't get me wrong. Teacups has been here since day one. But, on the other hand, the dark ride came online two years after the park opened. In fact, that's one of the scarier moments of Disney history. Because, again, they didn't have any walk-around characters for the parks. The real character costumes... And I know this will kind of blow people's mind. They didn't come into the park till 62.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, Disney, in fact, Bill Justice spent a lot of years designing character costumes for the parks. And just, you know, he had his favorite employees that he would bring in. You know, he would take a picture of you, your silhouette, you know, facing front to the side, and then would begin to sketch the costume around your silhouette on the photo.
Wow.
And then they'd have to fabricate it out from there. And then it was a question of, well, what materials work well in the parks and who's going to get a heat stroke while wearing this outfit? And that happens to this day. I mean, for example, the Buzz Lightyear costume that's in the parks right now is the fourth generation, because each time they've redone the costume, they've used lighter and lighter materials. The first Buzz Lightyear that went into the parks in 95, they actually had to pay workman's comp to a lot of the guys who got injured wearing these things.
Because it was so heavy?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just bad, bad stuff. Cool.
All right, so we're right now, we're in the middle of Fantasyland. We've got the castle behind us. We're sort of right over where Dumbo is. You guys can hear the background music, I'm sure. And you have the Matterhorn in the background. But walking over from... was King Arthur's Carousel always here?
Well, no. This was actually moved into this spot during the 83-84 reinvention.
Oh, really? It wasn't original?
No. Well, I mean...
A carousel wasn't original?
No, it was originally in the park. It was actually moved to this spot.
Where was it?
Well, it was actually further back. I mean, they... See, the idea was the castle... The carousel was actually moved here because it made a better kinetic when you came through the castle.
Right, instead of Dumbo.
Yep. So, I mean, everything you're looking at here, all of these, whether it's the elaborate, the rooftops, the Toad Hall next to the English, Tudor version of Peter Pan, this was all done for the 83-84 reinvention.
Speaking of Mr. Toad, was Mr. Toad an original attraction when Disneyland opened in 1955?
Very much so. Very much so. but again, the whole notion of, oh boy, I'm going to Disneyland so I can go to hell.
Yeah. So it's one of the classic attractions of Disneyland. I think it's probably my favorite ride in all of Disneyland's Fantasyland.
And speaking of pseudo opening day attractions, we're at the very edge of Storybook Canal right now, which is under, Monstro is undergoing a facelift, evidently.
Yeah, it looks like they're doing a refurb or something, because these large, billowy, gold-colored fabric all around Monstro.
But for opening day of Disneyland, the canal boats were here. They went the same route that they went, there was no landscaping. There was nothing here. In fact, the joke was, this was the tour of the muddy banks. It was only after the fact, like, God, what are we going to put in there? And
so the storybook canal, the idea wasn't,
1956, they spent the winter of 55, 56 building all the detailed models.
You think that fit in really well with, to me, the idea or the concept of the storybook canal boats is like a model train. You go through, you're in this train, you go through these little vignettes or cities or whatever. It just happens to be of children's fairy tales.
Yep. And it's again, one of my favorite off-color stories about the creation of this is that in the Italian village section, there are some metal roofs that were made of copper, and the problem was they had to look like it was a 300-year-old village. And, you have to discolor copper. And it turns out that there's...
I think I know where you're going with this, but go ahead.
All right. Well, the designer who was working on it found out that there was something that really helped discolor copper very quickly, and it was urine.
Ah.
So what he used to do is he would take the rooftops out, after several cups of coffee, and, just... outside of, WED headquarters and just pee on the rooftops and leave them out in the sun. And after 2 weeks of doing that, they were fragrant, but they were the right color. So, but again, that's the magic of Disney.
Amazing.
But, they've done amazing design work here right from the get-go. But what's fascinating to me is watching how each generation... the notion of what really good representation of fantasy is. Right. I mean, think about it. We're 6 weeks out now from the opening of the new Fantasyland at Disney.
Right. And they're actually incorporating a whole new generation of Disney princesses in there.
But at the same time, if you think about here, that just as you enter Fantasyland here, you come up the way past the Matterhorn. What do you walk by? You walk by the Disney fairies.
Yep.
In fact... as we're here now, they've added Periwinkle, Tinkerbell's sister that we never knew about.
She was the long lost sister.
Yep.
So. It's actually sort of interesting. You mentioned the princesses in Fantasyland, because in Disneyland Fantasyland, they don't have any of the modern princesses. Really, anything from Mermaid on. I mean, they've got the character greetings and stuff like that, and they've got a character greeting here, but there aren't any attractions dedicated to any of the characters that have been made in, say, the last 25 years, are there?
And, and what's kind of ironic about that is as early as 88, there was talk. In fact, if we'll just duck down here, this is where Mermaid was going to go.
So we're walking, now we're walking towards the Matterhorn part of Fantasyland. So we're between the Matterhorn and now it's a tangled meet and greet, but it's sort of the area between, it's the area between Matterhorn and It's a Small World.
And this is where the old motorboat crews used to be.
This is where so we're in a little dock-like area.
See, that's the idea, that the boats would... This is the offload here. The boats would come in here, offload, mm-hmm. and then you'd take your boat and go out.
So there's a little... Oh, I've never noticed this before. So there's a little waterway that goes past where the monorail pylons are in the back of the monorail. And it looks like it goes back out towards It's a Small World.
Oh, no. That's actually, it actually slides around the back of what used to be the Fantasyland Utopia. Now, though, is, you know, they combine the Fantasyland Utopia with the Tomorrowland Utopia. And, you know, so, again, it was another kinetic. It was, you know, Walt loved seeing, you know, things in motion that were going in opposite direction of one another. Mm-hmm. So the boats would go to the right, the cars would go to the left, the monorail would cross overhead, and it's like, this is busy, this is active, this is exciting.
Okay.
But, yeah, the motorboats had been an attraction that had kind of seen its day go, and... You know, here's Mark.
It was a low capacity attraction.
I mean, face it. You know, but at the same time, little kids loved it because they were the ones who were driving the boats.
Got it.
You know, okay. And so, you know, you ended up with this situation where, but it had passed its time. And meanwhile, here's Disney working on this brand new animated feature. And again, we're talking 88, you know, 89 or thereabouts. Mark goes over, Mark Eads, Imagineer of the Period, goes over and meets with Ron Clements and John Musker. And it's like, oh my God, this is great. We can do... And the idea was that you'd get on your boat and you'd float past scenes from The Little Mermaid. And then, you know, so little show scenes. I mean, you know, and don't get me wrong, they've actually rethemed this previously. I mean, for example, there was a time when they did a promotion called Afternoon Avenue, and... You literally got on your motorboat and floated through Gummy Glen of the Gummy Bears, and it was like painted pieces of plywood.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, well, you know, but it was only a 90-day long retheming of the attraction, and it was ridiculously popular. But again, this is, ironically enough, this is one of the most underutilized pieces of property.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, you look at it, it's really quite... We're now, at this point now, we're the only one on this little peninsula that around us. And we've got a bunch of ducks, and you see the monorail go around. But really, there's not a whole lot around it. They could really do a lot with this area.
Absolutely. But that
you have to be boat-themed, obviously.
But. Well, there you go. And this is always the challenge with, you know, with Disneyland. There is only so much land. And more to the point, in fact, what's kind of ironic is that the signs up here that say no smoking, this used to be one of the designated smoking areas for the park.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And, that's funny.
But they eventually decided that it's too pretty a corner.
It is.
You know.
Monorail's going past us. You can hear it. All right, so let's continue on. So if we go deeper into Fantasyland, if we head towards Toontown, we come up on one of the iconic attractions in pretty much any Disney theme park. And that's of course the churro stand. No, I'm kidding. It's a Small World. So this is the definitive version of It's a Small World. This was built for. So this is the 1964 World's Fair.
Well, and again, another great story that this is, you know, it's kind of ironic that the happiest cruise that ever sailed only exists because Walt Disney got pissed off. I mean, seriously, okay, you got to understand that it's 63, okay? And Walt Disney has already committed to doing, you know, the Ford Pavilion, which, you know, that actually, you know, that's where the dinosaurs for the Grand Canyon, the Primeval World came from. He's already committed to doing Carousel of Progress. He's already committed to doing Lincoln. And he suddenly gets a call. You know, or rather, his office gets a call from UNICEF. Okay. And they're like, you know, Mr. Disney, you know, Pepsi-Cola has agreed to fund an attraction for UNICEF. And, you know, what we're going to be doing is taking the money that we make from the attraction, giving it to the children of the world and wondering...
The children, Walt, the children.
The children. And it's like, and here's the thing that, you know, Walt's very well-meaning assistant is like, all right. We're doing three huge attractions. We are stressed to the limit doing this. We are in the middle of design of Walt Disney World. I mean, Walt loves children, clearly. Mm-hmm. But we're overdrawn. You know, we can't do anything else. So I'm really sorry, but, you know, we're going to have to say no. So, oh, okay. And somehow word gets back to Walt.
That somebody said no without Walt, actually.
And that's the thing. Walt just gets... curious. It's like, I am in charge of this company. What is the name of the studio? Walt Disney said, I'm the one that said, we're going to do this ride. And it's like, Walt, we got 9 months. So what the hell are we going to do? It's, I don't care. And so, you know, so it's like, show me what the building is going to look like. And it's literally this weird, you got a boomerang-shaped L building, all right?
Okay.
And so, Walt, all right, okay, all right. Because they've got the pad picked out, and, you know, so, all right, Children of the World. All right, so he turns to Mary Blair. It's like, you know, your storybook arc, your very, very simple storybook arc. Give me a kid. And so, all right, draws a kid, and it's like, hands it to the animatronic fabric creators, and it's like, look, I want this kid.
300 of them.
300 of these kids, all right? Then turns to Ellis Davis and says, look, start the research. I want every nation of the world represented as a child. And it literally, it was one of these things where everybody was just backed against the wall and just, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to deliver. And even Walt, when they opened it, you know, 9 months later, it's just like, I can't believe we pulled this off. I mean, just the fact that, you know, there was actually this day where they finally fired it up. But this was the version where the children each sang their own national anthem.
Really?
Seriously, they actually did the test. And so it's like, you know, over.
That's the Swedish national anthem for those of you that are listening.
And it was one of these things where it's like, oh, God, this is awful. And it's like, get me the Sherman Brothers. And it's like, and it came in, and again, same thing. It's like, well, what is this, Walt? Well, I don't know, but you're writing this song.
It's a celebration of children.
You know,
go.
And that's it exactly. In fact, but again, to give you some idea of Walt Disney, the businessman, they wrote Small World. They in fact, the song that's played in Small World now, Robert Sherman will tell you right up front, it's the placeholder. It was the thing they knocked out before lunch. It's like, all right, we're going to do the good version later, all right? But Walt, we're thinking along these lines, you know?
Here's a couple of riffs that we got.
It's like, you know, it is around. It's like, no, that's good. That's perfect. That's okay. We're going to do that.
And, print.
And so, you know, it just goes out the door. And so, you know, they go over to Imagineering. They see the mock-up. And Walt is literally, Walt's driving the Sherman Brothers back to the studio. And so Bob's in the front seat, Dick's in the back seat, and, you know, Walt's driving. And, you know, well, you know, I guess that turned out okay. And, you know, but it's not our best stuff. It's like, you know, we should tell you what, it might be a nice gesture to we'll just, any Muse money that song makes, if the rights are, if anybody wants the rights, we'll give that money to UNICEF. And Walt slams on the brakes, pulls over to the side of the road, and it's like, boys, don't do that. All right, that song's going to be feeding your grandchildren. All right, you know, that's the gift that keeps on giving. It's like, there's no way we're giving the rights to UNICEF.
And, for anything, yeah. For
you know, and sure enough, I mean, you know, they just, this is the song that's lived on and on and on and on.
It's 40, 50, almost 50 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
And should do a special commemorative version of it, 50 years at the 50th anniversary in 2014.
Okay, you heard that, Disney Consumer Products. Get on
exactly,
that.
Exactly, a CD of it. So.
But yeah, I mean, so, you know, it's a success at the 64 World's Fair. So, and again, that's the brilliance of Walt the businessman. The language that was written in the contracts for all of those things is, I design them, you pay me to build them, you pay to install them, and then I get to keep them. And so, you know, Walt had, you know, he got the track from, you know, the boat track that was in this for years was the one for the 64 World's Fair.
Really?
All the figures. I mean.
So it was the same shape, the building was the same shape?
Well, they torqued, you know, the track a little bit. But yeah, I mean, this was, you know, the huge success coming out of the fair. And it, again, when they, you know. I always find it interesting to see what was carried over to Disney World. And from the moment, you know, this opened at the fair, it was always going to be part of the Disney World. It was like, you know, this. And again, when you think of it, how fast it was made and how quickly it was slapped together, the fact that it was just so sincere, so, you know, such a home run.
50 years later, still around. Yeah. Really, the outside of the building, too, is really, really pretty. They've got trees mixing with topiary, mixing with water. And then the building itself is just different versions of white and gold, different shapes. It's pretty much every geometric shape you can think of.
It's so funny you mentioned the trees, because you'll notice there are trees actually up on top of the building.
Yeah, fake trees.
Okay. All right. They're designing this building for Disneyland. And, you know, it's literally, Mary Blair is working on this thing and is trying to decide where the trees go in front of the building. So just so she has something to work with, she's putting the trees on top of the building just temporarily. So she's moving the bushes and such around in front and deciding.
This is on the model or on the
actual? On the model. And Walt comes into the shop like, oh, trees on top of the building. That's really clever. We should do that.
Genius.
It's like, but it's no.
I just put them there for so I could drink my coffee for a second.
And it's like, nope, they're going in. And that's that's just how Walt rolled. That just, it was like, that looks great. Let's do that.
That's funny.
And
I like the shape of the trees in the building. So a couple of them are sort of inverted cone shaped, but it's more parabola than cone. But then you've got one that looks like, you guys that are listening know you've seen these chairs, and they're sort of like egg shaped chairs in which sort of an oval shape, but it's like a cocoon. You can sit in it, and it's an egg. Imagine an egg with a part of one side cut out on a pedestal. They've cut a tree out so that the inside of the tree is hollow, and around it is sort of that cone shape. And the funny thing is Jim and I are talking. There are birds flying in and out of this huge tree. Apparently, they've formed nests in there.
Well, it's so nice to see that Edward Scissorhand found a place to work.
Yeah, really nice. So. All right, Jim. There's one more attraction that we haven't really mentioned, and it's sort of the big unmentioned thing in the park. It's the Matterhorn.
The Matterhorn.
The world's first tubular steel roller coaster, I might add.
Yes, but again, another colorful story. Walt had gone on vacation to Switzerland and just fell in love with it. He was there when they were on, you know, went to visit the set when they were shooting Third Man on the Mountain, and just fell in love with this mountain. And, you know, came back. And you also have to understand that this is 57, 58. And this is about the time that Disneyland is so successful that imitators have started leaping up.
Okay.
And, in fact, to really gall Walt, though CBS would not get involved with this television series, CBS agreed to fund, along with Lawrence Welk, if you can believe it, Pacific Ocean Park, which was the first of the Southern California Disney knockoffs. And, you know, they had a submarine ride, they had train rides through, you know, a jungle. And Walt was, frankly, offended that somebody was ripping him off. And so Walt decided he literally had, you know, it's like, it's time to claim the high ground, literally. All right, we have to make a statement. We have to show that we are the number one in the industry. And so he, you know, went to Roy and said, I'm thinking, wouldn't it be cool if we built this? And he throws down the postcard that he brought back from, from his trip to Switzerland. And Roy is like, oh, God, you're high. it's like, Walt, you know,
you want to build a knife-making factory? Wait, wrong postcard.
You know, we still have financial partners here. We have to share. I mean, that's the thing people got to remember, that ABC, because it picked up a third of the was getting a third of the gate.
Really? For how long?
Well, till Disney bought the mountain, 61.
Wow.
You know, and, likewise, Western Publishing was getting a cut, and likewise, any of the restaurants. I mean, you know, that the Silver Banjo, you know, that's Don DeForge got money from operating that restaurant. It was like, well, we haven't paid this off yet. And so, oh, okay. All right, you're right. Now, when are you going to Europe? Well, I'm leaving next week, and I'll be gone for 3 or 4 weeks. It's, okay.
Okay, we'll talk about it when you get back.
That's right. And literally...
And they did talk about
it. Well, that's the thing. That Walt...
Here's the decision I made while you were gone.
That was it. You turned the Imagineers... one of the guys... I was in the room when Roy said no. It's like... said, look... Uh-huh.
And where's Roy now?
That's right. And so it's like, if we can get enough steel going by the
time... 21 days.
That's right. He can't say no. And sure enough, that's what happened. And in fact... not to, and I'm hesitant to bring this up because they have, over the past 10 years, they have basically replaced every piece of steel in the Matterhorn. I mean, it's a brand new attraction. I mean, it looks like the classic attraction, but this thing went up so fast that I remember in the 70s and 80s, you know, that when I was just getting started writing about the Disney company, and I came here with a veteran Imagineer who had brought his children along for the day. And he literally turned them and said, you can go in anything in the park, but don't go on the Matterhorn.
No.
And it's like, why? It's like, I've been inside that thing.
Have you seen the steel?
You know, I mean, it's just like, that thing is in such rough shape. It went up in 9 months. It just was thrown up. And just the notion of, you know, and the fact that they then decided, I mean, initially it was just single cars. And if you look now, it's double cars going to the mountain.
The cars are a lot heavier now, right?
Yeah.
Especially after the last...
And it's just sort of, you know, just totally stressed out a ride system that was never built for this sort of thing. But, you know, but now, very different. Very safe. Very wonderful.
Yeah.
I don't think it will fly off the track and kill anybody. I hope.
No, but probably not. It's a great ride. It's also iconic in the park. You can see it from Frontierland. You can see it all around. It along with... It's probably more than the castle is the thing that defines where you are in the park.
Well, that's, in fact, two great stories that are Matterhorn related. Back in the 1960s, Walt was so proud of this thing that starting 61, 62, you knew it was Christmas in Orange County because they would put a 30-foot-tall rotating star on top of the mountain.
Nice.
And they would, you know, they'd throw green lights on at night. And it was literally the area's giant Christmas tree.
Yeah.
And, in fact, it was kind of a statement of what happened to Disney after Walt died. I was talking with Van France one day, and it was 68. You know, Walt had been dead for a year or so, and they still put the star up, but it was so difficult to keep the rotating mechanism going. To hell with it. And, you know, the after-work hangout was the Disneyland Hotel. You'd go there and drink at the bar. And you look out the window, and it's like one of the guys was, Walt Disney was still alive. That star would be rotating. And it's like, you know, and you'd still have a job. But the other thing, speaking of coloring the mountain, back when the Disney company, the first time Disney was going to acquire the Muppets, they decided that they really had to do something big. They had to do something, you know, a statement to say that the Muppets are now part of the Walt Disney Company.
Sure.
And they came up with this really elaborate scheme to celebrate the Muppets coming on board at Disney. And what it was that it's starting in January of 91, that there would have been these series of full-page ads in the trades and Los Angeles Times and that sort of thing. Basically, it's like Mickey talking about, you know, it's like we really enjoy meeting with people. But it's like we'd love a vacation. And next thing you know, the next day in the same paper, there's a note. It's like, Kermit the Frog, well, we could watch Disneyland if you wanted to go on vacation for a while. And the idea was that they were literally, the Fab Five were going to leave Disneyland.
Wow,
for
that's a risk.
That was the notion that, for a PR point of view, they were going to travel around the country and they were going to make promotional appearances, go to the big cities, and you know,
sure.
But the Muppets were going to take over Disneyland
a bad idea.
Oh, but the plans were amazing. I mean, for example, you came up to, you know, what was then the marquee of Disneyland, and there was this piece of canvas that had been thrown over the Disneyland name and rudely painted Muppetland. You know, and then, you know, they Muppetized attractions all over the park. I mean, for example, if you went through Pirates of the Caribbean, where the men were chasing the women around, they're going to swap out one of the pirates and replace him with Animal. You know, but the thing that really was going to nail home that the Muppets were in charge of Disneyland for the summer. For that summer, they were going to paint the Matterhorn Kermit green.
Oh, clever.
So, you know.
That would have been a great idea.
But again, you know, that deal fell through when Jim Henson passed away. So, sad.
That's a shame. All right, well, that was a really great review of the development of Fantasyland. What do you say we head off into Toontown next?
There we go.
All right, great. All right, for Jim Hill, this has been Len Testa. You've been listening to the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. Thanks very much for listening. Please leave us feedback on iTunes, and we'll see you on the next show.